everyone, and welcome to Nikonian's Image Doctors. This is episode number 45 for July 19th, 2007. I'm Jason O'Dell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And thanks again for joining us as we delve into the world of Nikon and photography.
Yep.
And we've got a pretty fun lineup today.
Because yeah,
we went shooting over the
so.
Weekend.
Yeah, which is always a good thing.
It's better than being behind a desk. You know? It's one of my favorite things to do. Duh.
Yeah. So we'll talk a little bit about that, which involved a quick photo excursion up to the Mount Evans area, and that's a place that we talked about. You know, we were discussing Colorado shooting locations.
Yeah, photography at 14,000 feet mm-hmm. or thereabouts.
Or thereabouts.
We're going to talk a little bit about a refresher course on the image histogram on DSLRs.
Because, by request.
We know that's been a popular topic, and people can't seem to get enough of those things like that.
Right.
And then we'll also talk a little bit about techniques for highlight recovery, which is something that you can do if you shoot in RAW mm-hmm. most of the time. And then, of course, we'll have our weekly photo prescription.
Right.
And so we'll talk a little bit about that. So let's start with the weekend. We got up way too early on not yesterday, Sunday morning.
Yeah.
Didn't
absolutely.
We? And we're still feeling
it. And if you can't tell, that we're recording this the day after, so we're both sleep deprived.
Yeah.
No, we had a good time, but we did get up early Sunday morning. We'll talk a little bit about that in a sec. What we did is we drove up to the Mount Evans area, and for those not familiar with it, it's about a half hour or so, or at least that's where the turnoff is, about a half hour to the west of Denver. Up in the mountains, and then you drive about another 45 minutes from there up to the top of Mount Evans. And it's a mountain that's a little bit more than 14,000 feet high, and it's got a good piece of trivia is it's got the highest paved road in the U.S. It goes up pretty much to the top, mm-hmm. just right below the summit.
So, yeah, you can drive all the way up to this 14,000-foot peak.
Yeah, and it's very nice, actually.
Mm-hmm, very nice. A little windy at the top, of course, but
yeah.
You'd expect that at 14,000 feet, and gets kind of chilly up there, too, even in the middle of summer.
Yep.
But not too bad if the sun is out.
Yeah. Now, this was your first time up there, right?
That's correct. I had not been up there previously, mostly because I didn't want to wake up at 3 in the morning and drive there.
Yeah.
I didn't know there was a 3 o'clock in the morning until this trip. And then, but we were smart and we stayed in town just below the, below Mount Evans in a town called Idaho Springs.
Right.
And that was a real easy base camp to do and, has all the amenities that you need and so makes for a good breakfast when you get back down the hill.
Yep.
After the shoot. But, Mount Evans is diverse, especially this time of year, because there's any number of subjects that you can be going after. Obviously, landscapes. Mm-hmm. Sunrise in the high altitude is a very wonderful thing to experience. Second of all, there's a lot of wildlife up there. And just as a, real quickly, we saw chipmunks, marmots. I think you can see pika. Mm-hmm. Which are these other little rodent things.
Yeah, we didn't see them on this trip, though.
No, but you can see them up there. And then mountain goats, which is what Mount Evans is well known for, as being probably the most surefire location for finding mountain goats that you can go to around here, at least. So, and we found all of those, except for the pikas.
And we also saw a herd of elk way above timberline, which was really strange. I haven't seen that before.
Yeah, that was interesting. In fact, I saw a post in the forum the other day. One of our fellow Nikonians had posted that he saw elk above the timberline at Estes Park in Rocky Mountain National Park, and that was interesting. So we saw them too. And then the other thing you can get this time of year is all kinds of macro work if you're into that, depending on the light. But the wildflowers were in bloom a little bit below the tree line. Mm-hmm. And then there's some alpine stuff that's growing too above tree line. Very interesting.
Yeah, out on the tundra kind of.
Yeah, if you're into mosses and little alpine flowers, there's all kinds of stuff, and just a matter of what you want to do. So, of course, we did our typical routine since we had the car and packed everything.
Pretty much.
Fortunately for us,
embarrassing, virtually.
We didn't have to go too far from the car, and that was one of the things I really liked about it, is that other than being at the altitude, which can cause some people problems, because sometimes altitude sickness will happen. And it doesn't matter what kind of shape you're in, it can just hit you.
Yeah.
We didn't experience that, but we didn't have to walk very far from the car. Just got out the tripod, set it up, and then went out you know, within 100 yards of the vehicle where we had parked, there were plenty of opportunities for landscapes.
Right.
So we did that and waited for the sun to come up and the wind. It was cold.
Yeah. It was about 45 degrees out there, I think.
Yeah, but the 30-mile-an-hour gusts of wind
kind of made
it a little more intense.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, we shot the sunrise on a place called Summit Lake. Mm-hmm. And this is right below the summit.
Strangely enough.
Yeah, it's... I'd say it's probably about 1,000 feet or so below the summit. I mean, there's still a little bit of a drive up to the top from that.
Yeah, it's actually several thousand.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a couple thousand. I think Summit Lake, I want to say somewhere around 12,000 or something like that. And then you've got another a little bit more than 2,000 feet up to the top.
Okay, so where we were, there was sort of a tundra kind of habitat, alpine. A lot of mosses, some wildflowers, lots of water. There was lots of little pools.
Yeah, it was very squishy too.
Yeah, that's why I brought my plastic knee pads.
Yep,
and which was a very good thing to bring when you're getting down there. It encourages you to use low angles when you have protection for your knees. And you go above that, and then it starts just turning into rock.
Right.
When you really get above that 12 or 13,000 foot mark. But we did that, and then we turned around, and as we were getting ready to move on, we saw the herd of mountain goats just about 300 yards from where we were standing.
Yeah, it was kind of funny because we had actually gone up the night before up the mountain just to scout things out, and we thought, well, you never know. We might see some mountain goats in the evening, which would have been great, but we actually didn't. We never found them at night, so in the morning we were kind of wondering, well, I wonder how far away they'll be, but... They are really very reliable. I've never made a trip up to Mount Evans in the morning, at least, and not seen the mountain goats. Sometimes in the evenings, I've had trouble locating them, but never a problem in the morning. So,
and you bring up a good point. Good. We went up the night before, even though we didn't have to, because we wanted to scope out where things were. So the next day, when we were thinking about shooting wildflowers, because we sort of did our trip and our shoot in three phases in the morning. Sunrise landscapes, and then from about, I'd say from about 7 till about 8:30.
Yeah, because the sun came up at 5:45. Mm-hmm.
And so I wouldn't say between 7 to 8:30, we photographed the mountain goats. And once we had our fill of those targets, we moved down to just below the tree line where the wildflowers were really in full force. Mm-hmm. And... had we not gone up the night before, we might have noticed it, but we had a good idea of our plan.
Exactly.
So we might not have done the full pre-visualization of the shot, but we were thinking about it. We were certainly looking for spots to set up the night before. So when we got up there and you're groggy because you got up at 3:30 in the morning, it made it go a little bit more smoothly.
Yeah. And I think that planning is important too, because the light can change so quickly that unless you've got a concept for what you're going to shoot and at what times, you may just miss the good light.
Mm-hmm. And the good light, I'll tell you, it was fast.
Oh, it's very fast. I mean, and I think that's something that a lot of people don't appreciate that haven't shot at the higher altitudes and places like that, because with the air being thin, it's pretty intense. There isn't that nice haze that you find down at sea level. Like in places like California, I've really noticed it, where it just kind of softens up the light for an extended period of time. And it may not be quite as warm, but it's still kind of soft and it can work well for photos. In the Colorado mountains, the light tends to be very direct, very strong, and it doesn't take very long at all before not only is the warmth gone, but you've got a lot of glare and unattractive light.
Yeah, we had nice warm light, but it went from being alpenglow to direct harsh sunlight very quickly.
Oh yeah,
and that makes it really tough, because then you got this tremendous range between the sunlit areas and the shadows, and
yeah,
it almost makes it too difficult to get good images.
Yeah, speaking of that, let's talk a little bit about that first phase with the landscape stuff,
right,
and how we were shooting and what we were using.
Well, we both went for sort of a similar approach. After I set up, I quickly discovered that I wanted to use the widest lens in my bag. Mm-hmm. So I reached for my Sigma 10-20, and I think you used your Nikon 12-24 for the most part, correct?
Yeah, I used the 17-55 a little bit too.
I was going to start with that.
Yeah, I actually shot from around, oh, I don't know, you know, maybe 14 up to 45 millimeters. So pretty wide range.
I looked at my shots, and the majority of them were in the 14 millimeter area as well. And I tried to do some fun stuff and really go for, when you shoot that wide, you really need to have a foreground element. Mm-hmm. And so I was getting down on my hands and knees. I set up very low, because anybody can shoot at eye level, mm-hmm. I figure. And I found some of these little pools where there was fairly still. There was pretty windy, so I didn't get the kind of glass-like reflection that you might have, but I could still get colors and shapes and in the reflecting pool. And then I made sure that there were nice big rocks. In this case, there were granite rocks with lichen all over them. And I put those in the foreground. And in these cases, I was maybe only a couple of 2 feet, maybe, you know, less than half a meter from the foreground elements. And they worked quite well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I did some similar things, plus some wildflowers in the foreground too, which was kind of nice, you know, splash of color that was showing up. Now, were you using grad filters?
Yeah, I was using a three-stop soft grad.
Yeah.
And that was almost enough. I probably could have had more, but it worked out. And, it gave me a shot that was close enough that I didn't have too much extremes when it came to processing the image. I had to maybe tweak the exposure a little bit, but not bad at all.
Yeah. What I ended up doing, again, the light is pretty intense. So when that sun is coming up and hitting the mountains, the foreground is fairly dark because you just don't have all that humidity and stuff to diffuse the light and throw it into the shadows. So I was actually using two stacked grads. I was using a two-stop hard and a two-stop soft together. I could have used a three-stop hard and a one-stop hard, which I had. But the reason I went for the soft in addition to the hard was it gave a little bit softer edge that wasn't quite as pronounced and wasn't quite as sensitive to positioning.
And when you've got mountains in the background, that can be kind of tricky. I mean, you have to be careful with your grads because otherwise you'll start to see strange artifacts of the grad filter. Yeah. But I didn't see too much trouble. I mean, I have the ones that I screwed up where the grad filter was blown around at a weird angle, or you turn the camera vertical and you forget to rotate the grad filter. But we went through, and you don't have a whole lot of time, so I did a lot of stuff sort of without thinking, and that's why preparation and a little pre-planning and being comfortable with your equipment is important. If you just go there and you expect to get it right, you might not have the kind of results that you wanted to, just because there's a certain amount of time that you spend messing with your equipment that you could be shooting.
Yeah. And with the light changing so quickly, I find zooms to be just wonderful for that kind of shot because you only have a few minutes. I mean, just a couple of the really nice light. So if you want to get more than one shot and you've got grads, you know, set up in the front of your lens, you don't really have time to switch the lens, take the grads off of one filter, put them on another one, get them positioned, get them lined up vertically, you know, using the depth of field and everything. You just don't have time.
Right.
So the zoom is great because you can, you know, get repositioned, recompose, and you definitely shave at least a minute off there. And that's enough.
That could be 10% of your shooting time.
Yeah.
With that kind of light.
Yep.
So that's what I did, and sounds like we did fairly similar approaches to it. I know we weren't shooting in the exact same spot.
Oh, you know what I did? I had a polarizer, too.
Oh, yeah?
In addition to the grads.
This is a polarizer that fits in your cooking holder?
Yeah, it's the one I talked about a long time ago that I hate and you know, cut me up bad one time on a shoot. But fortunately, it was better this time because it wasn't as cold. But that was nice because that took the reflection off the rocks. The water to a certain extent didn't get rid of the nice light coming down that you were talking about earlier, the gold light coming off the mountains. But definitely saturated the vegetation, you know, with more color. So it was kind of nice.
So all in all, that was very, very interesting.
It was fun.
So we did that for about the first, I don't know, 45 minutes. And then we moved over to see the goats.
Yeah. And like you were saying, we decided, okay, let's go find the goats. And then we looked the other direction. I was like, oh, there they are.
Yep. So we had a real short drive over to the other parking lot.
We should have been embarrassed driving, actually, but...
Exactly. We could have easily walked, but just for the sake of our gear. So we packed up into the car, drove 30 seconds, and parked in another spot. And then for the mountain goats, I think we both started with our 70 to 200.
Yeah, that was just because we weren't sure if they were going to stick around.
They were very close and fairly tame.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we were within 30 feet of these goats. In fact, we were within 15 feet of these goats.
There were times where they were 6 feet away.
Yeah. Making faces at the goats. I remember doing this. Or maybe that was a dream. I don't know.
It could be.
And then I toyed around with my new TC-17 and got very good results with that. And I was shooting... I put my camera into standard wildlife mode. And, you know, again, thankfully, this is why you have custom banks.
This is the Jason O'Dell autographed wildlife mode setting.
That's right. Yeah. It puts my name, inscribes it right on the sensor. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a custom function. But if you've got a D200 or a D2 body and you've got those custom functions, this is the custom banks, and you wonder, well, why the heck do I need these? This is the kind of day where that's great. It's not even thinking. So I have a shooting bank that says wildlife, which has got the color mode that I want and the contrast mode that I want, and pretty much sets me up for fewer maneuvers in post-processing later and gives me pretty good JPEGs out of the box. And then my custom settings for the camera, I switch between... when I shoot wildlife, I change up a few little things from my normal settings. As we've discussed before, we have the, you know, decoupled AF on setting as our default. I have a wildlife or an action shot setting that has the shorter autofocus lock on setting.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of normal, it goes to a short or even off kind of setting. And then also auto ISO in my action setting.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I don't want to be thinking about, setting ISO when I'm trying to concentrate on wildlife. So I have my auto ISO set up so that the lowest shutter speed is 250th of a second. So that meant my ISO, and I usually set the ISO in the camera to not go below 200 when I'm shooting sort of moving action wildlife.
Right.
That's a pretty safe bet that I'm going to get a good combination of freezing the action and high quality if I don't need a lot of, if there is a lot of light.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that tends to work out. So I was shooting in that in aperture priority mode and around F8 with the converter on, and around F5.6 without the converter on. That gives you a nice sweet spot, and that worked really well. And then you went out back to the car and dug out the big gun,
right?
Which was the 200 to 400.
Yeah, and threw it on a monopod.
And that worked. I tried that at the very end, and that seemed to work pretty well too.
Yeah, it worked great. And for the mountain goats, because they were pretty close, I was shooting without a teleconverter on the lens, and, you know, looking through the images, I was usually between 200 and 350, 380, something like that. A few times I got up to 400, but because they were pretty close, I didn't have to. But boy, it's sure nice being able to zoom with that lens. That was great for subjects that are moving around on you quite a bit.
So I'm assuming with the longer lens, you were doing mostly portrait-oriented work.
Right.
And what I was shooting with the beauty of the 70 to 200 was I wanted to get some of the background, because these mountain goats were right down by the lakeshore, or they were sort of on a drop-off. And so the lakeshore was the background behind them, and they were in this field of these wildflowers. And so I wanted to be able to capture some of that setting that they were in, and being able to go wide with the 70 to 200 helped me for those shots. And then to really zoom in, I went with the teleconverter or the longer lens.
Yeah.
So it just depends on what you're trying to get. But we had enough time with them that there was plenty of time to go back and forth and change equipment, and they didn't run away.
Yep.
Then we got back in the car.
And then we photographed marmots briefly.
That's right, and you used the 200 to 400 handheld. You were a maniac. And I have proof of it. I took a picture of you.
Oh, did you? Holding that thing?
From behind, yeah. And
it actually worked pretty decently.
It, you know, for short periods of time, it can work quite well.
Well, the problem is, if if you're not familiar with marmots, they like to sit out on rocks and stuff. And as you're driving by, you see, oh, there's a marmot. And as soon as you stop, then they wait about 10 seconds, just long enough for you to find your camera, get it positioned. And then they drop off the rock and hide in a hole.
Exactly.
And, so we found some marmots that were off the road, and I think you got a few good ones just right from the car, right?
Yeah, and we used the car as a blind technique, so yeah. I was in the back of the car, and so I rested the lens just sort of on the windowsill there, and that was just enough. I had enough room to maneuver, and I nailed that sucker.
Yeah.
I mean, every piece of hair on its fur is just deadly sharp and looks fantastic. And of course, using that 200 to 400, there's a creamy green background. Yeah. And it just, I love that lens. Yeah. It renders great images.
Yeah. Now, since I was driving, I couldn't do that. But when we spotted some marmots, again, you know, we pulled over and I got the lens and kind of traipsed down the hillside amongst a bunch of rocks and things and snuck up on a marmot, which is, you know, always good to do. It's fun to stalk and stuff like that. But I started handheld, and then as I got closer, I got behind some rocks and eventually just plopped the lens down on a rock. You know, I put the tripod mount actually on the rock, and that worked pretty decently. And with the VR turned on, I got extremely sharp shots. And I think I was using the TC14E teleconverter.
For a little extra.
Yeah, because they're not, marmots aren't big.
No. And if you've never seen a marmot, these are... my dad affectionately refers to these as mountain woodchucks.
Yeah.
They're the same genus, Marmota, as woodchucks are, and in case you needed to know that little piece of useless
trivia. Thank you,
Dr.
Science.
That's right. But they do in the summer, they have a real short season above ground. All they do over the summer is get fat. They eat and get fat because they go back underground and they hibernate all winter long. Because they live in this kind of harsh climate. So right now, the marmots are fat and happy, and it was nice to see them.
Yeah, they're fun to photograph.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of personality.
So then, without running over any chipmunks, although we came close,
yeah.
There was a few least
just
chipmunks.
Just about nailed one, but...
Fortunately, it went back across the road the other direction.
Yeah.
And those were least chipmunks. I looked them up.
Ah, okay.
The tiny little guys. Then we found a nice patch of wildflower, and there was... Indian paintbrush and I think some Canterbury bells and all kinds of, you know, purple ones and white ones and yellow ones and red ones. And
right.
That's how I classify the flowers at least.
Yep.
Cause I don't have a degree in botany. Thank you. That was a little bit challenging, and we both opted for a little different approach to that. And we both brought our 105 macro. So it wasn't because of equipment.
Right.
But where we were photographing was an east-facing, darn near vertical cliff, hillside on one side of the road. So on one side of the road, there was a mountain. And on the other side, there was...
2,000-foot drop-off.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
In the mortal words of Arlo Guthrie, there was just a cliff in the air. You know? And fortunately, we didn't run into the mountain.
By the way,
we went over the
one
cliff.
Brief thing that we should mention. If you have a problem with a fear of heights, if you're acrophobic... Don't go there.
Yeah, because there's no guardrails on these roads.
There are no guardrails.
You can look down.
Yeah, it doesn't bother me. I don't think it bothers you, right?
No, it didn't bother me.
I think it's kind of fun, but I know some people panic on that road.
But, I didn't walk too close to the edge, but that's a different story. So anyway, here it is, and by this time the sun is up, and we still have golden or fairly yellow warm light, not white yet, mm-hmm. not midday light. But so these flowers were... You know, on the positive side, they were completely front lit. On the negative side, it was a little hard to work because...
A lot of contrast.
There's a lot of contrast, too much contrast almost, if you're doing serious macro shots. So you had brought your diffuser.
Yeah, I think we talked about these a long time ago, mm-hmm. some shopping list kind of topic.
Yeah, your PhotoFlex 5-in-1.
Yeah, it's a great invention. It's really nice because the way it works is it's got... on the inside, a diffuser, which is just a white translucent panel that you can put up against your subject and it'll let light through, but very diffused. So, you know, for flowers, it's great. And that's what I was using the other morning. It just gave very nice, evenly lit, nicely saturated flower photos. and it completely avoided the harsh lighting thing. But it's also got some surfaces that you can zip off that include a gold reflector, a white reflector, a combination silver and gold, and I can't remember what else, probably silver. But those can work well for flowers too. When we were shooting up in the Black Forest area a few weeks back, and I was using the gold surface to throw in some warm light on flowers that we were photographing that were in the shade.
So it's one-stop shopping for that product.
Yeah, it's, and it even will shelter the flowers a little bit from the wind if you do have some like we did. So
I was watching you. You had your tripod set up, you had your macro lens set up, and then diffuser in one hand, and then we're using a remote release?
No.
Okay, so diffuser in one hand and then taking the picture. But that works out, and that's another reason to invest in a tripod. It's that extra set of hands that you always need when you're doing that. Now, I chose a slightly different approach, at least for some of my shots, and that was I wanted to try out my fairly new 10.5 fisheye. And what's really neat about the 10.5 fisheye, other than the fact that it has a 180-degree angle of view, is that it focuses down to an obscenely close distance. I mean, it focuses down to several inches, I think.
Yeah.
And so I found myself about 6 inches from some Indian paintbrush in the foreground, and these things fill the foreground. And then I got trees on the mountainside and blue sky.
It's a cool look.
And it's really interesting.
Yeah, I think both approaches that we used work well.
Yeah. And it doesn't look like your typical fisheye shot.
Yeah.
But the fact that it's distorted, you don't notice it because it's flowers everywhere, and you wouldn't you wouldn't have any reason to think it was distorted.
Yeah.
You know, your brain doesn't perceive it that way. So that was pretty fun too. And so we had, all in all, we had quite the haul of photographs.
Yeah. I think it was successful.
That was pretty good.
Yeah.
And then we went back down the hill and had a breakfast and made it back home.
Yep.
And we're tired. Still
very tired.
So one of the things that we were using a lot on this trip, well, on any photo shoot, but especially landscape shots when you're working in quick and fast changing lighting conditions, it is essential that you understand how to use the histogram on your camera, because that is your friend when it comes to judging your exposure.
That could be the title of this segment of the show. The histogram.
Yes, the histogram and you.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think they ever made Army training films on histograms.
But they could have.
They could have, yes.
Could have told you which kind of histograms you shouldn't go near, and never mind. I don't know if you can catch anything from a histogram. But, okay, next. What were we talking about?
Lost my train of thought.
Yeah. All right.
Histograms. We've talked about them a little bit in the past, and what they are a graphical representation of the tonal values that are in your image. Mm-hmm. And on the left of the histogram, you can think of it as a graph. And really the important axis, you know, the graph has an X-axis, a vertical axis on the horizontal, and a X-axis, a Y-axis is the vertical.
You're sleep deprived, right, aren't you?
And once upon a time, these were called abscissa and ordinate, and I don't remember which one is which, but that's okay. It doesn't matter. You just look on the horizontal axis.
You got the thing one that goes up and the thing that goes to the side.
That's right. And the side-to-side one is the important one. On the left is black, none blacker. Mm-hmm. And on the right is pure white. And
like the White Album.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So on the right-hand side, you're thinking the Beatles. Mm-hmm. On the left-hand side, you're thinking Spinal Tap. Or maybe Metallica if you're
one of the two.
So that's good.
I like that.
And then somewhere in between is everything else.
Yeah. And the gray zone.
And the everything else doesn't really matter. And the overall shape of the peaks and valleys in your histogram doesn't really matter. But what does matter is the overall skewedness of your histogram. And in other words, you should see something that has mounds in it. You should see something that looks like a little, you know, mound-shaped distribution of tonal values, but it might have peaks and valleys. What you want to avoid, however, is to have a whole bunch of stuff piling up at either end of your histogram, especially the right-hand side.
Right. That represents, because if you were thinking White Album again, toward the right is the White Album, and that's where you have potentially blown out highlights. And that's a white area of the picture with just no detail whatsoever.
Right.
And the way you'll see that on a histogram is if you look toward the right, you'll see a spike. And it just goes right up the right-hand side and doesn't come down gently or anything like that.
Exactly.
And, now, and that's a bad thing with digital.
Sort of to answer a question that we got emailed about, the height of the spikes in the histogram is the number or the count of tonal values that have, or, you know, it's the
how
relative
much data
amount.
Is there.
Yeah. I mean, if you think if you took a picture of a neutral tone gray card, you would get a single spike in your histogram.
If it was all, a really perfect really good gray card.
Yeah, and you'd have all of the values. So you'd have one tall spike because all of the information in the image would be on that one tonal value mapped to one number.
Now, if you photograph a real one, what you'll see is a hump that's centered in the middle.
Right. Because it's not perfect.
Right.
You know, there's always a little bit of variation. Mm-hmm. Now, that hump can move around across your histogram, but your range of values is it goes from 0 to 255.
Black to white.
Black to white. Once you hit, because this is digital, once you hit 255 or 0, there are no other tonal values that that information can have. So if it's 256, it's counted as 255.
Right.
If it's minus 1, it's counted as 0. So what you'll see is that spike represents a lot of data starting to pile up in that 255 or 0 bin.
And to use our favorite Spinal Tap analogy, you cannot go to 11.
You can't.
Yeah.
No, it just starts piling up.
Right.
And then that indicates that you have a problem.
It's very ugly looking. You'll just get these blank white sections of the photo. And in general, it's not attractive.
Right. I mean, take a picture of something with an overcast sky in the background and you'll know exactly what we're talking about.
And everyone has seen that. It's not just a digital problem. Happened with film too. Slide film was pretty sensitive to it. But also when you were getting back color prints from a processor, if you had a really wide range of tones in the subject, you know, shadows in the foreground and an overcast sky, you'd see that print come back looking pretty solid white and ugly.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is the remedy? How do you fix this if you start to see stuff piling up on the highlights? In other words, you're blowing the highlights out. Well, the quick and easy fix for that is to use the exposure compensation button on your camera and dial in negative exposure compensation. Mm-hmm. So minus 0.3 or minus 0.7.
And how much you use is something that you'll just have to learn over time. It, you know, like we've talked about before, digital is wonderful for experimentation. So try some stuff around the house, and soon you'll start getting a sense of how much to dial in based on how much spiking you're seeing on the right.
And rarely, I mean, I find me personally, I rarely go above like minus 0.7.
Yeah.
I mean, that usually does it. I start with 0.3, and if that's not enough, I'll go to 0.7. I've rarely needed to dial in more than that.
Yeah. Now, the key to that, because I would say my experience is the same, too, but you also have to learn how to read light and know what kind of light will work for a photograph, you know, what's going to be too extreme of contrast range, and therefore, when do you start using the grad filters that we were talking about earlier? When do you use the diffuser? You also use some flash, right, on
correct.
The flower shots.
That's
when
another
you
way
use
of
fill flash.
Yeah.
Those are all ways of reducing the contrast range. And so that can be another solution to the spiking histogram kind of
right.
problem.
Right. And then another thing with your histogram is just to keep in mind your subject. If you are photographing a polar bear, your histogram is going to be predominantly shifted to the right if it's exposed right because it's a white subject.
Yeah.
So the fact that you have stuff between the 0 and the 255 doesn't matter. It's only when you start to see stuff piling up to the right or to the left where you might want to consider using exposure compensation to balance that out. So if you see a weird looking histogram, the only weird histogram is one that looks like, you know, a curve that somebody stepped on.
Right.
And then you want to go about fixing stuff.
Yeah. Now, a couple other things that are worth talking about. Sometimes, you know, people that are relatively new to digital, you know, hear, okay, you don't want blown highlights. And so what they do to avoid that is just shoot everything with negative exposure compensation dialed in.
No.
Don't
go there.
Don't do that either. It may be safe in terms of blown out highlights, but like we discussed when we were talking about handheld meters, that's a surefire way to get a whole bunch of noise in the shadows.
Right, because you're going to have to bring that detail back in your post-processing, and why not get it right the first time?
It'll look kind of ugly. You'll get noise in the shadows. You'll get lower contrast. You'll get weaker colors. You know, all sorts of reasons not to do that. It's
bad. That just sounds bad. Now, there is one, and then on the flip side, sometimes small spikes, we mentioned the height of the peak. Mm-hmm. If there's just a little tiny spike on that high end, on that right hand side of your histogram, it's quite possible that what you're picking up is something called a specular highlight.
Right.
Which is like a reflection off of, think of it as a reflection off a chrome or a catch light in somebody's eye. Those are going to be blown out no matter what you do, and that's just fine.
Yeah, you don't want to worry about getting detail in those areas.
So it's okay for a catch light or a specular to not have any detail in it. So you shouldn't worry about dialing in compensation for that. What you should worry about is large areas of your image where you want detail, not having detail. So white fur on a sunny day or white feathers. You know, there you might want to use exposure compensation to get some detail back.
Right. And by the way, a really nice thing to do there is to use your histogram in conjunction with little blinking highlight feature, which I think pretty much every DSLR has.
Right.
And what you can do is if you see a spike to the right, you can just toggle to that setting, and you can see how to set that in your manual.
It's called highlight warning.
Yeah. And that will flash the area that's blown out. So that way you can see if it's a little specular area and not a problem, or if you're getting, you know, whole area of sky, which, you know, certainly could be a problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that, you know, that's sort of the histogram. And now the thing is, people will tell you, well, you can't always trust the histogram on your camera, especially if you shoot RAW, because it's generated from an 8-bit JPEG image, which is embedded in your RAW image, and, you know, it's not going to be completely accurate. Are they right? Yeah. Should you worry about that? No. I think as a general rule of thumb, the histogram is a good thing to keep you honest. But what you're going to find is that if you shoot RAW, you're going to have a little more latitude in doing something called highlight recovery, which we're going to talk about next. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you only shoot JPEG, then that histogram is your friend.
Right.
And you should really try not to blow out any highlights, because if you shoot JPEG, you've really got no chance of recovering any detail from that image in post-processing, no matter what you do.
Right. Now, one last thing, and we'll make this pretty quick on the histogram, is some cameras have an additional option for histogram kind of data where you can actually see histograms for each of the three primary colors.
Right, the red, green, and blue histogram.
Right. And that's not a bad thing to use. I normally just stick to the composite one, that just a single. But where the three separate colors can be nice, again, going back to the Mount Evans thing, if you're photographing something like Indian paintbrush, which is a very orangish red flower, it's easy to blow the reds.
Right.
And you won't see that necessarily on the composite view. So with subjects that are really skewed toward one color, it's not a bad idea to check that.
And I think on some of the older DSLRs, isn't the histogram off the green channel primarily?
I believe so.
So, you know, that's only one piece of information. And most of the luminosity data comes from the green channel, but having the other ones, it can be nice for that very reason.
Yeah.
You know, you won't have blown any highlights, but you will have potentially blown a single color.
Yeah.
So you lose detail in those reds, so you can put in exposure compensation, even though you wouldn't normally think to do it looking at the regular histogram. You can recover detail.
And when I have a problem there, it's usually reds.
Tends to be the one that blows.
Yeah.
So then what if you shoot in RAW? And in RAW, you're afforded a little bit more latitude than if you shoot JPEG. And you can do something with a lot of RAW processors called highlight recovery. And there's a whole bunch of different, I mean, each RAW processor does it differently. I know some of them have an automatic checkbox where it says highlight recovery and a slider, and you can dial it in. I know, doesn't ACR have a highlight recovery mode?
Yeah, a new one.
Bibble had a highlight recovery mode. And what it does is that there are, in the RAW file, there's more data in there. And so it's looking at stuff that might have been blown out when you have 8 bits worth of data in a JPEG. And it's going into that more deep data set.
What it does is, you know, you've got several different color channels. And if one of them is blown out, but you have data in the other two, it can use those other two to try to reconstruct,
correct,
you know, what the situation was. And it works pretty decently. You can, very safely get, you know, about a half a stop of highlight recovery and maybe just a tad more. Then it'll start going kind of gray on you, which right. still may look a little bit better than whites in some situations, but you're not really doing much. But the only raw converter I can think of that doesn't have it is Capture One. And there's supposedly a new version of that coming out late this year.
It'll have a true highlight
I think
recovery.
That's the only one that doesn't have right. it.
Now, Capture NX doesn't have highlight recovery in the traditional sense. It does, but it's a two-step process. And highlight recovery in Capture NX requires that you first use the exposure slider
right.
in the raw adjustment section of base adjustments. And you slide the exposure compensation to the left, and then that'll usually bring the highlights back. And then in later steps, either with levels and curves or LCH or delighting, you can then, or control points even, mm-hmm. you can adjust the brightness of the areas that you made too dark and bring those back while leaving the highlight areas intact at that lower exposure setting.
Right.
And that works pretty well most of the time. Mm-hmm. It's not quite as elegant as the built-in exposure compensation, or sorry, built-in highlight recovery
as
slider,
a separate slider.
As a function its yeah. own self. But it does work. And there's, you know, like I said, there's a couple of different ways of doing it that I know I've tried, you know, LCH, levels and curves, delighting, or control points, and all of them have their pros and cons, and they all work mm-hmm. pretty well. Mm-hmm. There's some examples of that. I don't know if we have examples of that in the post-processing forum in our NX tips and tricks links. I know I've got them in my ebook, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't
where
think
else
we do.
They are, you know, I know I give at least two or three different examples of highlight recovery
yeah.
with the different methods. But
the nice thing about highlight recovery is that you can live on the edge a little bit. Terms of exposure.
Yes.
The one thing that we didn't mention earlier is if you're shooting raw and you have a choice between having your histogram skewed to the right versus the left, you actually want to go to the right. And that would be a whole other long topic, but it does help with shadow detail and noise and all that kind of stuff. It's more than just the noise.
When you say skewed to the right, you mean just slightly. You're not talking about having, you know, an image where the histogram is, you know, piled up on the right. You're just talking about not centered on the left. It's centered to the right.
Yeah, but actually, neither one is much of a problem if you're shooting raw.
Because you can recover a lot more detail later, yeah, either yeah. in the shadows or in the
But since, given that you are better off skewing it to the right, highlight recovery gives you a little bit of a buffer where, you know, if you're generally checking your histogram, but you miss it one time and you haven't horribly blown your highlights,
right,
you can still get a good photo.
I mean, if you've blown the highlights out by a stop or two,
you're toast.
You know, it doesn't matter what format you shot.
Yeah.
They're done.
Right.
You just have some room for error with raw. And that's why we like raw. It's, like we say, it's sort of like the ultimate safety net.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when people say, well, why don't you shoot JPEG? I'll tell them, because I'm not good enough. I'll make no bones about it. I'm not good enough on a consistent basis with the kind of photography that I do to shoot JPEG and always get it right.
Yeah. Now, one tip related to the highlight recovery, and then I think we can move on to our prescription, is always get your, if you're shooting raw, you know, get your white balance and your major color correction done first before fine-tuning, you know, the highlight recovery slider or the exposure compensation slider. And the reason is that sometimes when you make a more dramatic change in the white balance, you'll actually blow out some things that weren't blown out before. So getting those things fixed first and then doing the highlight recovery as the next step keeps you from iterating.
Yeah, and one thing I've found is that if your white balance is truly off, I mean, like you shot tungsten instead of daylight or fluorescent, and you do have some blown highlights, even in raw, it's very hard to correct with the white balance settings and get the highlights to look right, because
mm-hmm.
it's just data are lost in those areas, and the raw converter just doesn't have anything to work with when you change color
yeah.
to color temperatures.
But give it a try.
Yeah.
If you've been shooting JPEGs, try shooting some raw images and try the highlight recovery. It's quite nice.
So this,
all right.
Yeah, we'll finish up here with our weekly photo prescription. And we wanted to talk about vignetting control. What is vignetting let's start with the definition of what that is. And what we're talking about is generally referred to as vignetting, or sometimes called light fall off. It's where you see a darkening in the corners of your images. And you can see this for a lot of reasons, but usually the reason is that with some lenses, when you shoot them, a lot of times you'll see this when you shoot wide open with a lens.
Lenses wide open tend to have more of a
problem.
You'll
just see, the light intensity isn't uniform from edge to edge across the image mm-hmm. circle.
Wide angles tend to have more of a problem than telephotos.
Yes. You'll see it with some of the DX lenses because they were designed with a smaller image circle.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I see it a little bit with my Sigma 10-20. I mean, of all the things I love about that lens, the one thing that it does exhibit is a little bit of light fall off in the corner. So my blue skies, the corners look a little darker.
Right.
Not to the point where I'm going to like rip up the images and throw my lens away, but it's there.
Mm-hmm.
And what we want to talk about is ways that you can use some controls in post-processing to adjust this effect.
Mm-hmm. Now, virtually every RAW converter I can think of, if you are shooting RAW like we talked about earlier.
And even some that aren't RAW converters, even just Photoshop.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but all the RAW converters pretty much have a vignetting control that you can adjust, usually via a slider. Mm-hmm. In some cases, it can be an automatic compensation like the DxO stuff mm-hmm. will do. But that's one way of doing it. Like you were saying, you don't have to do it in the RAW conversion process.
But that's
Photoshop or Elements or whatever right. have a vignetting control in it.
So you don't have to shoot RAW to get this I'm saying. But
no.
if you do, yeah. you can get a better quality result potentially.
Yeah, but it'll just usually be a little slider and you just adjust it by eye and just look at the corners and get it to the point where what you see there is looking good to you.
Right. And typically what you're doing is if you move the slider in one direction, it'll make the corners darker. If you move the slider in the other direction, it'll make the mm-hmm. corners lighter.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the time, you're trying to make the corners lighter if you're trying to correct for light fall off in the corner of your images. And, that works pretty well. What I found also worked pretty well when I was processing my images from the weekend was sometimes the vignetting control, and I was doing this in Capture NX, and it's in base adjustments. There's a vignetting control slider. I found it wasn't quite enough because the light we were dealing with out there was pretty strong and it made the skies were pretty dark, and so I cranked it up to the maximum and it got rid of most of it, but there was still a little effect and I wanted to get rid of the rest of it. So I found a real easy trick was mimicking off when we gave our earlier prescription for creating that pseudo polarizing filter effect with mm-hmm. a control point. I dropped the control point from NX in the middle of the sky and just dialed back the brightness slider a little tiny bit. And it was amazingly useful because yeah. it only corrected the tone of blue that was the lighter tone in the center of the sky, and it left the dark corners, or the darker corners, alone.
Mm-hmm.
And so with a very small correction, I had a very uniform-looking sky.
Yeah, and you just probably tweak the radius a little bit.
Just a little bit, yeah. That was all I had to do. And
yeah.
the next thing I knew, and it didn't affect the rest of my image. It
yeah.
didn't affect the corners of the sky. I mean, it only picked up those tonal values that were the light part of the sky.
Yeah. Now, one last thing that we'll mention while we're talking about this vignetting control is you can actually use it to deliberately darken the corners.
That's now, right.
Why might you want to do that? Well, it's actually an old darkroom technique involving burning in the edges of the photo to give more attention to what's in the center. And that could be something like a portrait or whatever, but it makes your eye go toward the middle and where your subject might be.
Right, which is why the slider moves both mm-hmm. ways.
So you can use that creatively, too, not just to fix an optical problem,
right.
but as a creative technique. So, give it a shot, and it's kind of a cool look. Vignetting is not always bad.
Not always bad.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that brings us to the end. We somehow slogged through another episode, and we're still alive to talk about
yep.
it. So tell your friends to tune in to the Nikonians podcast at podcasts.nikonians.org. And don't forget, as always, you can go and vote for us on Podcast Alley.
Yeah.
We need all the votes we can get so that somebody somewhere says, hey, look how cool we are.
I'm sure something good will happen if that occurs. I'm not sure what it is.
I don't know.
Why not?
Yeah. Maybe if we get some magic number, like confetti will fall from the sky.
Could be.
new Nikon lenses might show up or something. I don't know.
Doubtful.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, see you guys in 2 weeks.
Or 10 weeks.
10 weeks. It seems like 2 weeks. 2 weeks. And until next time, happy shooting.